to get involved in the schools. Again, Hampton Middle School or Junior High School up the street here was, you know, this area was had good schools because of the quality of the parents. Hutchins, where I started teaching, didn't have high student achievement because of the lack of quality of the parents. And it wasn't because they didn't care, but many of the parents were uneducated, probably had to work hard, and so there wasn't much they could give or do for their students. They expected the schools to do that. And again, the good parents, in my mind, were those who would support you in discipline, but they couldn't do much for you education-wise or curriculum-wise because they just didn't have it. Many of them were not high school graduates.
Do you think that the Annenberg Challenge contributed to Detroit?
What's the Annenberg?
The Annenberg, it was a grant of $5 to $10 million to Detroit for education reform.
I don't remember it, to tell you the truth. Okay. Probably, like so many other of those special funds, many of them never got down to the classroom. Or they got there in minute quantities.
Okay, why don't we shift a little bit? Let's talk about your AFT.
Okay.
Do you remember when you first went to an AFT convention?
Lord, no. It was, I assume, back in the 60s, but I don't really remember other than I frankly consider most conventions to be a waste of time.
Did you join the Black Caucus, though?
I don't think I did. Well, let me explain.
Okay.
You go to a convention, and all you get are goddamn speeches. You might have a committee meeting where you make a nice-sounding decision, but was it ever really executed in the local school districts? Rarely, I think. At least not in Detroit. But conventions are nothing but talk.
Mm-hmm. A lot of talking.
Yeah, a lot of talk and a lot of expenditure of union funds that would probably be better used at the local level.
And you were also a member of the AFT Executive Council?
Yeah.
1982 starting?
Yeah, well, I'm from one of the bigger school districts. It's just a natural thing.
And AFT makes sure that the bigger school districts are well represented.
Well, I mean, you're AFT president. You want vote to stay president or to become president at the convention. So you always court the delegates or the union, local union, that has the biggest vote at a convention. It's just natural politics.
Do you think it would be different if there was a secret ballot instead of the open ballot?
I don't think so. The reason I don't is the average delegate doesn't know anything about the national anyway, or knows damn little. So they will take, at least in my experience, they will take the recommendation of their leader, which is the president of their union, or the chief delegate.
What were some of your memories on that? Serving for AFT Council?
Not a heck of a lot, to be honest. We would go, we would listen, we would vote. We had good intentions, I'm not saying that. But in education, one of the things you learn, not after the fact, not too long after the fact, that, you know, there are fads and styles and so if you get Lyndon Johnson with one theory of education, Kennedy with another, and Lord knows who else, that was what was the practice, largely because it brought money to the district. Whether it was successful or not, I suspect was questionable.
Okay. How about, do you remember your trips to Africa?
Oh, yeah, I remember them well.
One's at Ghana, Nigeria. Why did you go to Ghana and Nigeria?
I think that was some kind of union function, wasn't it? Let's see. I know there were a couple of union conventions in Africa.
And that's with the Education International?
I don't think so. Anyway, there were a couple of union conventions in Africa at some point. I know because I was on the AFL-CIO executive board here in Detroit. I think that was when I went to South Africa for. Basically, we went because, hey, we wanted to go there. What's the old homeland like? Not too much different from here, really. The poor were just a little poorer, that's all. But some of that stuff up there is from Africa.
Okay. And did you talk about union democracy or unionism in Africa?
I talked about it, but Africa is a different world from here. And hey, a few well-off people rule there. And poor is poorer than here.
Now you mentioned, all right, now going back to Detroit.
Okay.
You mentioned Sneed. And I remember reading that Sneed was, Superintendent Sneed,
mm-hmm.
had tried to do, he got voters to pass a millage for construction on schools
mm-hmm.
with no plan.
Yeah, well.
Was there anything that, could you kind of explain what happened there?
Well, you said it. There was no plan. Look, I have to say one thing about Detroiters. Detroiters as a whole have always supported education. You cannot find anything that Detroiters were asked to vote on that was supportive of schools that they didn't support or they didn't vote for. And so Sneed took office and asked for a certain amount of money to improve the schools, and by improve the physical characteristics of the schools, and he got it. But as we found out, he didn't have any plans. I don't know what happened specifically now because I just don't recall. But most of that money either went to waste or it never spent. Well, let me say this about Sneed. Sneed didn't know how to be superintendent. That was his biggest failing. He was a principal. He was one of those principals that either he just coasted through the job or he gave orders, they were followed. And you don't do that as a superintendent. As a superintendent, the first thing you got to deal with is the Board of Education. And you can have some nice people, you can have some sons of a bitches on those boards of education. So you have to stroke them. You have to sit down and talk to them and all that good stuff. I don't think Sneed knew how to do that. He was the principal at Cash Tech, which is arguably the best school in the city, or was then, and still is for that matter. And so Sneed issued an order at Cash. It was followed. And because the students at Cash were from some of the better and most educationally supportive families in the city, whatever the parents wanted, the parents at Cass got. Well, I mean, hey, they were off better off economically. They were usually city leaders of some kind. And the school district in those days depended on support of the citizenry for millage, for example. And any research will show you when it came to vote on school funding, damn few people voted. And it was usually neighborhoods like this one where most people have an education and some dollars. And in the poor neighborhoods, they just didn't vote for, they just didn't vote, period, not vote for. They didn't vote on anything, hardly. So you had to keep your middle class happy. And since most of the school board members were from the middle class, they wanted to be stroked. Sneed didn't understand that.
All right, just a couple wrap-up things.
Sure.
Where you started out with the DFT very early. mm-hmm. when I was first getting there, and you left when it's nice and mature. Can you kind of explain, tell us, where do you think the DFT is going? And
now?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going much of anywhere now. It's just about as far as it can get. I mean, the DFT is still involved, not to the extent there were, in city politics. And in politics, period. Unfortunately, and this is a criticism, my successor, Janet Garrison, just doesn't communicate or get involved with the community. When I was president, I was active in the 14th Congressional District. And I was on the board. At one point, I was even president or whatever the title was. I would go to community meetings. We had a coalition of unions, and my logic behind that was that even though the teachers' union is the union that is listened to and respected and all that good stuff, if you want citywide support, you have to have people out in those communities speaking for you. Teachers don't live all over the city. I mean, at one time I could identify within a few blocks where teachers lived. And so if you get sections of the east side where no damn teachers live. So therefore you wanted something like the custodians, the secretaries, a few others who live there and might have had some voice in that community and might have been able to get people out to vote or to whatever was necessary. I could do it here, but unless I got some solid support from the newspapers or something, the people on certain parts of the east side just didn't give a damn. So you wanted the custodians and the secretaries and the paraprofessionals out there talking it up for you, not to mention that they lived in these communities. And so, I wanted citywide support, and citywide support meant getting the right people to talk for you. And that's not happening now. I had a coalition of unions, of all the unions that represented employees. We would meet regularly, usually monthly, to make policy decisions. And I assume those folks went out and talked it up in their communities, or talked it up to their members, whereas that's not happening now.
Where do you see the future of the union movement here in Detroit, as well as Michigan?
I don't think there's a problem. The UAW is in trouble because the units they represent are moving out, or the Japanese are taking over. But even they are getting into government representation because they are losing members. I mean, the UAW is, if they've got half the membership that they had a few years back, and still going downhill. I think the future of unionism in everything except industry is in good shape. Because, we're used to it. People are used to the unions, negotiating for them, speaking up for them. The elected officials want the unions behind them to get them reelected and to get tax bills passed and stuff like that. Our politicians want union support at elections, whether they're state legislature, mayor, or city council, you name it. they recognize that unions are important when it comes to turning out folks to vote.
All right, last question.
Okay.
Looking back on your career as a teacher, as a union leader, what do you look back at and laugh at?
I don't think about it very much, to tell you the truth. I thought I had I have a pretty good record of representing the members. And by representing the members, I mean more than just union-wise or grievance-wise or contract-wise. I think that was good, too. But, you know, some unions have to recognize that when you go out into the world, to Lansing, to community meetings, which I did, you are the image of the union that most of these people pick up. I mean, hell, even the reporters in the news and free press, you have to court them. I mean, their owners may be bastards, but a reporter can write an article that is makes you look good, or they can write an article that makes you look bad. A simple quote of the wrong kind can create a poor image. So, yes, I would court Ron Russell and some of the other reporters from the news and free press. And even though, again, their owners or their editor might be a son of a bitch, excuse my French, they could sneak in a word, John Elliott said, you know, that kind of stuff, that made you look better than you would otherwise. You have to, and again, you just have to get down to the basic people. And let's face it, newspapers are in business to make money. And even the publisher doesn't want to offend union members, because hey, educated people, by and large, are the biggest subscribers to newspapers. So I think unions are in good shape as long as they know how to handle themselves. Don't get overly arrogant or overbearing or overly demanding. And this being a union town, it's a lot easier than some other places.
Excellent. Cool.
All right. The first question is, at the time you became a teacher, did you face obstacles being a black male in a profession predominated by white females?
No. The reason I didn't was, number one, I went to an all-black school. Now, I'm sure a large number of the staff were white, but many of them couldn't control the kids in my first school. That was Hutchins Junior High School, as I said. It was a, what you call, factory neighborhood. And so, no, I never had a problem. Hutchins probably had more males, not necessarily black, I don't remember, than the average school, because the people in personnel wanted that, because let's just say they believed that the males had more control over the kids than, well, again, the school I worked in later on up on Livernois and 7 Mile, than Hampton.
And when you first started working with the union, what was the racial climate of the city like?
Good question. I'm not sure that I knew or paid any attention to it. I mean, in the educational system, it was pretty good. I guess one of the factors would be the schools were pretty much overall segregated. I mean, you had, again, Hutchins, which was majority black students, I don't remember what the staff was, but they probably had more whites than blacks. You had Miller, which at one point was probably the only majority black school. Miller and what's that other school on the east side? Oh, hell. Well, Northern is one. I mean, there were, well, I mean, face it, this was a pretty segregated city at one time. And so I'm sure that the superintendent and his staff saw to it that the schools were segregated too. So, I think that was it. And any black teacher who wanted to go and stay at a black school was going to do that. I mean, the rule again was, when you were a student teacher, not a student teacher, when you were a new teacher, probationary teacher, you stayed a certain amount of time, 2 years, and then you went elsewhere. Well, it didn't always happen. I stayed at Hutchins longer than 2 years, and when I went to Hampton, I had used up any credits that I had to stay at Hutchins.
Now, can you tell us about the, well, beginning with the first position and the various positions you held in the Detroit Federation of Teachers?
Well, of course, first would be executive board. That's what you're talking about.
How did you get elected? Did they elect the executive board at that time?
Oh, yeah.
How Same were you now. Able to get elected to the executive board just starting out with the union?
Well, you have to keep in mind, number one, the union at that time was a white female-controlled organization. Mary Ellen Reardon was the president, had been the president for God knows how long. I don't remember. When I came in, she was the president, and what Mary Ellen Reardon said went. And so Mary Ellen and Helen Bowers ran the union. I'm quite sure when I got in, I started helping Mary Ellen and Helen out, taking fair, union responsibility. And since it was probably, and you'd have to ask her, it was recognized that blacks were growing as a factor in the city, or starting to, or would be, I don't know. And so Mary Ellen put me into responsible positions of one kind or another, committee chair, whatever, on the executive board. And eventually I gained some credibility on my own, but without her support, I wouldn't have gotten it.
And which work stoppage under your leadership as DFT president was your most memorable?
I don't know. Oh, they were all hell. I don't honestly know. There was one there where the school system was claiming they didn't have any money, and we were able to prove that they were lying.
Okay.
And we did that because, pat myself on the back, I was smart enough to hire a guy who had extensive knowledge of finance and soon became my financial expert on Board of Education Finance. He's still down there. Pat Falkerson.
Yeah.
I mean, Pat was a real rookie at one time, but he had that natural sense of finance. And even though he might not have known much about the school board or the school system or the school system's finances, it just came to him. And of course, I saw to it that he was fed information. And one of the good things about the collective bargaining law was that the school system had to give us information about their finances. They couldn't just say no. Not to mention that we had a couple of superintendents that didn't mind anyway.
And during your years of service, which people were most influential in helping you during your years of service to the union?
Oh, boy, that's a hard one. I can't recall, other than the few people that ran against me, like this fool Steve Kahn,
who were helpful.
I mean, the union was never badly split. And basically, as it's just the way it was, if I could keep the female members of the system happy, I had support. I don't know what it is, you tell me, but women, by and large, don't want to get deeply involved in stuff like unions or outside of work. I don't know if you saw the pictures in there, but there were instances where, you know, I'd be the only male in a group of people,
right?
And so I guess it was just the way it was.
And what was your most outstanding moment as Detroit Federation of Teachers president?
I don't know. There were just too many good ones.
Okay.
I mean, if I had to pick something, I would say it was going out again into the community and convincing the community that the school system needed a millage and the teachers were not going to abuse the money that should have been used in the classroom. Other than that, I would say, once again, it's getting all the unions to work together for the school system. Not just for the unions themselves, which we have to do if you want to stay in office. But, we go out, we convince people that this is good for the school system and it's good for the employees.
If you had to do it all over again, what would you have done differently?
Can't think of anything. I thought at the time I was doing what was right. I very seldom failed. I don't know. I believe, number one, in a system like this, you have to get community support. I think I did that more often than not. I think as a employee leader, you have to have strong internal knowledge about the system, particularly its finances. It seems like finances controls everything. So, again, that's why I hired Pat Falkinson, and I had some people before that, or I did it myself, depending. But you just have to take steps that you believe are good for the system and not harmful to the union.
And what message would you have to present members of the Detroit Federation of Teachers?
Stick with the community. Stick together as union members. Not stick together but with just some of the DFT, but with the other unions, which again, as I said much earlier, I don't think that's happening now, and I think that's a mistake. We just live in the same communities. And so you need people speaking up or saying good things about you.
What is your message to building representatives of the Detroit Federation of Teachers?
Well, I guess the same thing I said, other than make sure you represent your members and do it right. I mean, building reps have to get the union line out to the members in the building, and they have to assist the members with problems that they have with administration, or straighten them out if they're wrong. Which just happens. There are people who think that they ought to have their way, and they're not always right.
Thanks. That's solid.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks so much.
Okay.
I think we got some good things here.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely.